All right, there, Ed, there is three strikes, three more strikes for you, three more topics suggested this week by subscribers, so thank you for that. The little thing we've got going on in Telegram, I asked in there for some suggestions, so thank you for your suggestions. I've gone with three of them. They are this, pitch invasions and the conversations that that leads to about football and fans. Also, the wider UK feeling about Liverpool stroke Liverpool FC. There's obviously been plenty of it about. And then last of all, strike three is Joe Gomez, his future, what happens next, all that kind of gear. You've got me, Gareth Roberts, hosting, you've got Mo Stewart, you've got Josh Sexton, and you've got Neil Atkinson. We are starting with pitch invasions. There has been a spate of them. The FA have said they are concerned about them. Of course, Mark Roberts has been wheeled out to talk about them, and of course he had to go at football fans, and he started talking about a problem with cocaine, a problem with alcohol, all of this kind of stuff. Neil, pitch invasions and the conversations around, your feelings.
I think first and foremost is it's not great, it's not a good look, you know, and I think it's worth acknowledging that before we go any further. I think it's something which appears to be relatively new. I have a little bit of sympathy, certainly for the one in the aftermath of the goal, believe it or not, and this will seem unlikely, but with the Blue Brethren, I think it is something different, the idea of relief and exuberance in the moment versus celebration. That's not me letting anyone off the hook or anything like that, but I think I never felt at any point, even when it was absolutely feral at Anfield on Sunday, as though anyone was going to try and get on the pitch en masse. Really didn't feel as though that was going to be the case at Anfield. But I do understand the idea around the Calvert-Lewin goal that, you know, how keyed up Everton were and have been about this thing, that it just leads to just some people just absolutely, in a split second, completely losing the run on themselves. And I've got a bit of sympathy with that. And then afterwards, I don't think you're far away from... And again, I want to be careful here, not least because I'm really trying not to be rude about Everton in any way, shape or form. You're not far away from the fact that it felt it was almost encouraged, the thing at the end of the match. Like, Gunderson wanted that outpouring. Everton Football Club corporately wanted that outpouring, and those players did as well. And this is where you've got a really difficult fine line, because you've got what's absolutely beyond the pale in terms of what happens at City for a number of reasons, but especially because you can't have goalkeepers getting knocked around the head. And then you've got this feeling that Everton themselves were sort of all right with the idea they managed to create a massive Goodison Park moment, and that they wanted that to sort of occur the way in which it did. And that's why you end up in a bit of a funny line there, where, you know, and this is, and I am well aware, by the way, that I am in a huge sort of ethical grey area as I speak here between, so you think that one of those is all right and one of those isn't, Neil. I can't quite, I'm not saying for a second this would necessarily stand up to genuine interrogation, but, you know, this is just an immediate sort of feeling point. I think the other thing to point out as well in amongst this is it does happen in other sports a lot. There was a spate of it happening in cricket. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people getting invited onto the pitch in cricket after results. Supporters being almost encouraged again to come onto the pitch in cricket. You've seen it happen in rugby league a fair bit of the time as well. But obviously when it's football and Premier League football, it's different. And I'll say it again, the idea that players feel unsafe is... And now I've really good reason to feel unsafe, by the way, because one of them has been attacked on the pitch. And I'm not having to go at Manchester City supporters in that... Every group of supporters has a percentage of dickheads. Liverpool are in that number. Everton are in that number. Manchester City are in that number. Doncaster Rovers are in that number. You name them, there will be a percentage of dickheads. And because there isn't humanity. So you've got to be really, really careful. I never like high horse around football supporter issues, because you can really end up in a lot of bother, which, again, is another thing that you can say about our blue friends. You'll always be stung. There'll always be a sting in the tail if you try to take a high horse position. I really don't want to take a high horse position. I think, though, it is important that it's discouraged quickly from this point. I think it's important that the end of next season, because I don't think it's going to necessarily be happening at the start of next season. I think it's important, because there's only really one more game now. It's ours, and it's in the Stade de France, and that's not going to happen in the Stade de France. I think it's really important now that towards the end of next season, everyone is really, really prepared for it. And there's some comms from the clubs that... Yeah. I think Liverpool Football Club are quite good now at comms to the supporters to say, there's this thing on the horizon, whatever it may be. You know, a really good example of it that's completely separate and different to this was the stuff around when we had to go to Sheffield United for the first time and they come back up. The really good comms from Liverpool to say, there is this thing, but we've all got to do our best, and we know it's difficult, and this is where we are. Liverpool are good at that, and I think other clubs sometimes aren't. It's sort of saying to your supporters, you know, in a completely different way, you've done this thing, we need you to not do it anymore.
Well, you've had Klopp talk about, you know, lads coming on and grabbing the ball and things like that, and, you know, like that gets shared in a certain way, and a lot of people, you know, shrug the shoulders and say, well, what's the problem with that? Well, the problem is the club gets fined.
Yep.
The problem is that the likes of Mark Roberts and the likes of certain newspaper columnists and etc. get to say it's a return to the bad old days, blah, blah, blah. Like, I did a radio interview last week, and one of the questions was, well, what do you think about fences coming back into football? And I was like, wow, that didn't take long, did it?
And that is the huge concern, and that is what clubs have got to start saying, and clubs have got to find ways to say things to their own supporters that they might not like.
And supporters to each other.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I was gonna make that point, because for me, I think there is a distinction between what Neil was describing in terms of the letting yourself go with euphoria, and I've seen lots of videos where on arguments on Twitter threads where you see people showing videos of themselves and running up to strangers and just hugging them, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think we should be necessarily discouraging that, but there is a difference between that and going and trying to attack someone, whether or not it's out of spite or whether it's out of just like,
like the Vieira thing is just fucking horrible. Yeah. There's no need for it at all.
If you're
and
going
the Zaha thing, and the keeper thing and the Billy Sharp thing,
if you're going onto the pitch with any other motivation other than to kiss and hug the nearest person who supports the same team as you, don't go. That's the distinction. And I think you're right. The key is, it's not about worrying about what the powers that be are going to do to us. It's about us getting in there and regulating it ourselves before we give them the chance to come and do that. Because if football fans are doing it, if you're the kind of fact where basically if you see someone like, and you suspect that they're going on the pitch to cause trouble, and you're sitting next to them saying, maybe they're getting ready, you'd be like, what are you doing? Sit down. Like, there needs to be more kind of, we don't want to be tarred with your brush. Because that's really what the problem is. It's like, there are so many things that should be good, but there's a small number of people who corrupt it, and then that means that it gets taken away from everybody. And we don't want to have to continually do this in every single facet of life. We need to be able to say, look, guys, can you not just fuck it up for the rest of us here?
Yeah, I think there's this thing around the sort of protest as well. It hasn't been in the past. Like, we want to, you know, encourage fans to be able to sort of reclaim power and have these protests. But then, you know, you saw the scenes at Old Trafford when they had their protests against the Glazers. As Mo says, there's going to be, you know, a minority, and it is always a minority, no matter what people want to say, a minority of dickheads who want to use that as a vehicle for violence, as a vehicle for hooliganism, basically, and you know, use that and go and commit crimes, which is what it is, you know, assaulting players on the pitch and that kind of thing is literally committing crimes. I suppose the sort of distinction here is what, you know, as Mo and Neil have both alluded to, is that there's going onto the pitch in sheer euphoria, going on to, you know, hug your own fans, hug your own players, have that moment with your players. And you saw it in that Everton game that, you know, the majority of those fans who went onto the pitch went on to go and celebrate with the players, and their players seemed to lap it up. Like, all of the Everton players were sharing pictures on Instagram of them, like, hugging fans on the pitch. They were all sharing that picture that seemed to have been taken from the dugout, where you can just see like rows and rows of Everton fans for miles, and the players are all buzzing off it. I it's interesting, really. Actually, I had like a time hop come up on my phone that said like a couple of years ago I'd tweeted saying like, why are fans going onto the pitch, invading the pitch after playoff semi-finals, after winning playoff semi-finals, but basically saying like, you know, you've not been promoted, so why has that got any carry on? And I had a mate who's a Wigan fan coming back and saying like, you know, it's like the championship season, the championship itself is dead hard to be on the precipice of. That is not something that like you as a Liverpool fan would ever understand.
And it's a trip to Wembley and all of that kind
of
stuff.
So like there's something to be celebrating that, in so much as like, you know, if we got to an FA Cup semi-final, or if we got to an FA Cup final, if we got to a League Cup final, we would want to celebrate it. But then there's obviously like, you know, different strands of the means in which you celebrate. I suppose like the worry for me is you know, how do football clubs regulate this? How do football clubs stop this? Because we don't want to see fences coming back in. We don't want to see, like they've got in German football, the big, like, I don't even know what you call them, big like nettings in front of the ends and stuff like that. We don't want to see any of that coming, because it harms our football watching experience as football fans. It harms it for you know, the majority of us who do just want to go to the game and cheer on our team and exactly and as we've seen with the fencing and that kind of thing, it's unsafe as well. We don't want to return to those dark ages, because it's the lesser of two evils, them saying, oh well, we're returning to the dark ages by having fans attacking players, so let's return to the dark ages by putting fences up in front of the fans.
It has to be said as well, Neil, that, you know, it is, and this isn't just me being like, and you know, someone somewhere will probably listen to, you know, you sound like a busy or something, but it's a criminal offence.
Yeah.
And like, you know, whether you like it or not, it's a criminal offence, and like you can be banned, it can affect your life, it can affect your job prospects, all of those things. Like I always do say, and like not just because I'm mates with it, like you should as a football fan follow Amanda Jacks online on Twitter and look at what she's doing and look what her job involves and look at, and I talk to her all the time about how things that happen at football affect people's lives massively. And we can all say, and we all know, and you a little bit torn in what you were saying before about it's an emotional time of year around the football. It's not like this stuff happens in, you know, September or whatever. It is always now, and an element of it is predictable. But we've already seen that there is a strand within the police and the football fans that they want to make an example of you as a football fan. So, you know, like, look at the stuff that came out the other day about cocaine, like a 5-year ban.
Yeah.
Around that, well, that you wouldn't be treated that way if you got pharma cocaine in, like, in town.
Exactly. Yeah. There's not a strand in police, not even in English/British public life, that wants to make an example of football supporters. It's a mainstream view.
Yeah,
it's a mainstream view. Now, it might not be a majority view across the country, but it's not far away. It's a mainstream view. So by giving them easy wins in a current culture which is obsessed with finding ways, a political culture that's obsessed with finding ways to divide people, that's obsessed with turning us versus them in the most public way possible, front page news way possible, it's just giving them easy wins to enter into a phase of greater demonization of football supporters. So it's got to be stopped. And I do agree with the sort of the idea of we've got to stop it ourselves, and I think that we've got to have a sort of an awareness of that and around that.
Or at least be part of the conversations ourselves. Like, we don't want someone from up high, like in an ivory tower, making rules for us, because that's where it's ultimately not going to benefit us.
It's where it'll end up to a degree as well, and it won't benefit us. But I think it is. I think it's an important sort of. It's an important thing to remember, the demonisation of football supporters, and it's important to sort of hold to in a lot of key moments. And I think that you know, it is opening that up. As I say, genuinely watching live for my own personal reasons, the Calvert-Lewin goal, and seeing the immediate aftermath to it, I didn't for a second think, this is ridiculous. I thought it took too long for them to get off the pitch. But then seeing what happens to Patrick Vieira,
it's ridiculous.
It's scandalous, and it's bang out of order, and it's wrong.
The flip side of that, though, well, it's not really the flip side, another element to that is the fact that because we knew that if Everton won that game, they would be safe, end of, the police also knew that. Everton Football Club also knew that. So there's an idea around the policing and the stewarding where we're saying, because this is a special time that only happens a certain period of year, there's only like maybe a 3-week window where this happens, we have to commit more people to these events.
Yeah, no, and in general, there's sort of wider questions around the way in which football events are stewarded. But then what makes this difficult is, I think, for instance, the way football events are stewarded in terms of it being a security issue, I will spend months of a year arguing that that's bang out of order. When this stuff happens, it undermines my argument.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. And the problem around, you know, that's where all of these things...
I mean, you said that there was never a sense of it, and there wasn't, but they were primed for it at Anfield. And
you could
see there was more stewards, there was more police. They were all around the edge from, what, about 80-odd minutes.
Yeah. And I think that's fine. And I think all of that's understandable, and I think it's sensible. My thing is just, is to sort of say, you know, we want to go out of our way to be treated genuinely like customers at a sporting event. People don't like the word customer, but I think it's important, because what I don't like in football is when people, whatever we call the powers that be, whether it's regulatory bodies, the clubs themselves, the government, get to pick when football supporters are supporters, when they're customers, and when they're generally just going to be treated like scum. And that suits everyone, that conversation. When stuff like this happens, it makes it far easier to let them set that agenda and then win that argument. And that's what concerns me so much more. So, you know, I am aware, and please don't talk to me about it online, if you want to talk to me about it, talk to me about it on person. I am aware that what I'm saying here is a lot of very grey area stuff. Mm. I am really acutely aware of that. And I'm aware of the fact that, you know, often I try to sort of feel like I've got quite a coherent sentence or something like that. And I haven't quite on this, but what I have got a very coherent sentence on is that anyone who thinks for a second that other than in a congratulatory environment, as was there for the Everton players, which they seem to indulge and enjoy, putting your hands on or getting in the face of a footballer on the pitch or anywhere in life is beyond the pale. It's just, it's yeah. despicable, to yeah. be honest with you. Because you leave the footballer in this horrible position.
Yep. Josh, I wanted to ask you, like, in particular, you know, do you think any of this is in any way generational? Because for me, there's a thing about pitch invasions, which is, I personally, and I guess a lot of people my age would do the same, and a lot of people older would do the same. I link it to Hillsborough. I link it to the fact that there were fences. And when the fences were removed, the idea that you would then go and invade the pitch, well, no, because we don't want them back again. Now, Hillsborough, how much is it in the common conscious for, you know, younger generations? I don't know. Certainly outside of Liverpool, I don't know. Yes, there's been, you know, national documentaries, there's been national dramatisations recently with the Anne Williams thing and things like that. But still, you know, the way it gets lashed round on social media and stuff like that suggests there are some people that don't care. I wonder whether there's something in that, and also whether there's something in the social media side of it as well. Like, you know, a lot of these people on the pitch almost seem to be on there for content reasons for themselves. Do you know what I mean? Look at me on the pitch. Look at me with a player. Look at me winding up a player. You know, even this lad who behaved like a dickhead towards Vieira. You know, we got his film shared on social media, didn't we? We saw the perspective of Patrick Vieira's face and what this lad was saying to him and doing to him and sticking his finger in his face and all that kind of stuff. So it's like, you know, do you think some of the behaviour's fueling a generation almost? I'm blaming the kids.
Yeah, I'm always sort of anti, you know, making it a generational thing, because I think it's quite easier, particularly for someone from an older generation, to go, well, this is a new thing, so let's blame it on the kids. Because I think that happens like too much in today's society. To be honest, I think you make a good point about the Hillsborough stuff and the sort of linkages between that, because that's the lack of education, isn't it? Mm. There's people my age and younger outside of Liverpool who it won't even really come into their conscious that's a thing and that's an issue, that, you know, if God forbid the higher powers decide that, you know, we are going to bring fences back at football games, most people would just think that's shit because it's shit. They wouldn't think, oh, it's shit because it could cause the sort of thing that happened at Hillsborough. It could cause crushing. It could, you know, there's issues that it can cause beyond there just being a literal fence in front of your football viewing experience. And that's why I sort of, you know, interrupted Neil before to say that I think we as fans need to be a part of that decision making, because, you know, you think back to those times when there were fencing grounds, stuff like that, they were all decisions that were being made by higher powers. They were all decisions that were being made by the FA, by the government, and the government who didn't like football fans, by the establishment that didn't like football fans. And we're in danger of slipping back into that, to be honest. You know, mm-hmm. Boris Johnson can do all the sort of whipping up Rangers fans for Europa League finals that he wants. He's still not a football fan, and he would still be the first person in this country to throw football fans under the bus. And you saw it during the lockdown as well, by the way. You know, Neil talks about there being a mainstream anti-football view when you know, people were saying, oh, we need to get the football back on, you know, Boris Johnson was coming out, or the government were coming out and saying we need this back as an activity to sort of, you know, get the nation going again. People were going, well, why is it always about football? Why is it this? Why is it that? In quite a mainstream sense, they were doing that as well. That there is a real anti-football fan sentiment in this country, and that's why it's crucial that, you know, whatever decision is made around this, people like Amanda Jackson consulted, supporters clubs are consulted, supporters groups are consulted, and that kind of thing. Because otherwise, once the decision is taken out of our hands, once it's made by a higher power, it's not going to benefit us.
Two things about what you were saying about social media that I want to follow up on, that I fully agree with. One, social media is new, but it's not just kids, is it?
Mm.
I mean, we all know people, I mean, we're all on it a lot, mm. all of us in this room, and we all know that some of the worst people on Twitter are in their 50s. So, yeah. And that's not just in terms of what they're saying, but in terms of trying to do anything for clout. So that appealing side,
shitposting, yeah, all the rest of it, yeah.
The getting shit for attention, or trying to poke people for likes or for negative reaction, which apparently seems to be just as popular these days.
It seems to be fueling like in some circumstances. I don't want to be tabloid here, but a sort of extreme tribalism, not en masse, but you know, like there's a weird thing. I find that weird.
It's just a place of extremes in general because it's just so vast, and you've got.
I really don't like it anymore. I've got to be honest.
You've got everybody's opinion on every single subject, and if you look into that, you're going to see the best and you're going to see the worst. And in terms of the people wanting to go on to these things, wanting to see, wanting to put themselves into this situation, be like, oh yeah, look at me on the pitch and all that, and doing it for likes, doing it for clout, doing it for interactions. We can't sit here and criticize them if we're actually retweeting and liking these things, because we're giving them the reason. We're giving them the fuel to believe that that is a valuable thing, because we're giving them the numbers. So we can sit here and say that they shouldn't do that. And that video of from the Vieira thing is wild. I still think that was probably one of his mates rather than the kid himself. Because, I mean, come on. But that's the flip side. Like, if we are against it, we have to do all of the things that are against it, including ignoring it when it comes up.
Okay. Well, are we all happy on that strike? Or said your bit? Okay, let's move on. The next thing sort of ties in with it, really, and fits in quite nicely, which is the fact that we have seen certainly feelings about Liverpool and Liverpool FC from elsewhere a little bit more. Is this down to Liverpool's success? Is this the stand-up of your eight Man U type phenomena? Is it something different? Is it something darker? Mo, start with you on this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting for me.
Just wanted to say that the lad who suggested this was saying things like, why are Wolves and Leicester arsed about us, was the type of stuff that he was saying.
I mean, I don't know how much they are asked about us, or they are just asked about trying to insert themselves into someone else's story. Because that's, let's face it, the whole thing with Wolves on the last day, right? No one gave a shit about Wolves. No one was giving two shits about what Wolves are doing, including a large percentage of Wolves fan base, because the end of their season has been terrible. But suddenly they have a chance to kind of be a part in the story. So if they start mocking us, then they'll get support and love from City fans, and suddenly they're all involved. And it's all just a bit sad if you look at it from that perspective. So I'm not worried. The wider question about the reaction and the view of us from outside, I think part of this has been started from the discourse of the managers, both Tuchel. Guardiola started it, and then Tuchel was asked about it and he kind of chimed in along. I think from the manager's perspective, it's easy to try and create that whole, oh yeah, they're the favourites, everyone likes them, we're just poor little Man City / Chelsea who no one cares about. So, and again, it's so obviously transparent. But the fact that they were so surprised to be convincingly told that that wasn't the case. I mean, if you've seen the video of someone saying to Guardiola about the fact that United fans would prefer them to win the league than Liverpool, it's amusing to me, because it really is like he's being made aware of this for the very first time. He's like, what? That doesn't make sense. It's like, well, it kind of does. You're down the pecking order, lads. That's the whole point. And they're down the pecking order for everybody. We're not. We're high up in the pecking order for a lot of people. But I do still think, we're going to talk about this in loads of different ways, there's a very, again, an important distinction, I think, to make between people who have opinions on Liverpool from afar and people who come to the city. Because even the Wolves game, I was at Pogues and I got chatting to a girl at the bar, and she's a Wolves fan. And she said to me, yeah, I moved here 7 years ago, but my boyfriend's a Liverpool fan, so I've kind of come here. It's like, I know, I'm now a Liverpool fan and a Wolves fan. And that's the thing. When you come here, when you kind of get to see what we're really about, get to experience that joy and feed off of it, then you become consumed with it. You understand the city more. And I've seen so many people who have an opinion of it from the outside and then come here and are happy to be proved wrong. And that's the thing. There are the people who come here and are happy to be proved wrong and are going to kind of accept what they've given. And then the people who are just want to stay away and just use it for scoring points, for clout, for trying to poke at people. And those opinions I don't care about. I really don't care about.
Do you think it's just because we've got a good football side, Josh, or is it something darker, something deeper? Is there something else going on? Is there anything about the media? You know, that kind of thing. I mean, obviously, the front page on the Mail regarding the national anthem situation, when Wrexham fans booed the Welsh national anthem and didn't get a sniff, didn't see that on the pages. But, you know, I don't know, like, I mean, I'm looking at a headline right now, Sport Bible, Wolves fans taunt Liverpool fans with brutal Premier League chant after quadruple dream shattered. So fucking what? but it, you know, it fuels this bellendry, doesn't it? Equally, then we react in a certain way. There seems to be like a bit of a circle of shit going on around this.
Well, I think Mo's hit the nail on the head in terms of, you know, them wanting to be part of the story. It's giving them something to celebrate. Like, Wolves have had a shite end to the season. It gives them something to celebrate on the last day. It gives them a chance to put themselves into our story. You know, same with Leicester. Every time we've played Leicester in recent years, I know we lost to their place just this season, but, you know, it seems like the worst of their behaviour comes out actually when Liverpool are winning. It's because all of a sudden they've got nothing to celebrate, and they want to use that as a way to say, oh yeah, but we got under Liverpool fans' skin and stuff like that. I think it is darker and deeper, and it's carried over generations, because it comes from the idea that Liverpool fans are always the victims, and it's never their fault, and that is, you know, quite clearly. John Gibbons put a tweet out about this a few years ago, and I still retweet it to this day because it sort of echoes the sentiments I feel around this perfectly. Is you can't sing about Liverpool fans always being the victims and it's never their fault, and then turn around and say that the one time where Liverpool fans were the victims and it wasn't their fault. Like, the biggest incident of that is Hillsborough. You can't just discount that from you saying, oh, but you always are, though, you always are. But then that sentiment has sort of carried over years, and I think this is what I was saying about the education before of you know, of making sure that younger people in this country from outside of Liverpool know about Hillsborough, is because when they're carrying on this thing that all Liverpool fans are always the victims, and people from the city of Liverpool are always the victims, and you can get under their skin and you can goad them really easily with all these different things about Liverpool, you know, about unemployment, about poverty and that kind of thing, you can it's a really easy way to get under their skin. They need to know why. You know, why Liverpool fans react that badly. Why? Because the establishment for so many years has put Liverpool down. Why Liverpool fans would go to Wembley and want to boo the national anthem, they want to boo members of the royal family and that kind of thing. People need to, you know, try to understand that, and that's the thing that gets lost in the sort of social media world, I think, is that understanding is nuanced to any arguments, because every argument has to be, you know, it has to be the first person to say something, you have to be, you know, the first person to get something out in 240 characters and all that kind of thing, and that is what the social media world has created, I think, is a lack of understanding, a lack of empathy for others, and a lack of education, because you can get all the information you need as far as you're concerned at your fingertips, and that is where, you know, it should be that, you know, people are now being educated on why Liverpool fans will react badly to you singing about poverty and unemployment, why Liverpool fans will react badly to the national anthem and to members of the royal family and to the establishment.
Neil, me and you have talked not on air about, you know, it being a little bit weird at times this season supporting Liverpool and going to places like Leicester, and you're sort of on the end of real vindictive stuff, and you're like, hang on, what?
Leicester was, I think, the worst time I've ever had a football ground, certainly in the last sort of 10 years or so. Maybe it's just me being older as well, I think that might be part of it, but I just remember sort of standing in the grounds at Leicester listening to 20,000 people sing Feed the Scousers and thinking, why on earth have I put myself through this? This is really, really weird. I mean, it is weird. The Leicester crowd is weird in and of itself. I think there's a discussion to be had about the makeup of that crowd versus the makeup of the city of Leicester, and the nature of the city of Leicester versus the nature of the crowd that is Leicester City, if you see what I mean. But using that as a jumping off point, Leeds was a bit grim as well, but then you sort of expect Leeds to be a bit grim to an extent, but that was a little bit grim too. A lot of this, the Feed the Scousers thing, I think is really important in amongst it, as a place to start, and the reason why is because a lot of this is informed, learned for decades, predates 1989, predates lots of things. Mm-hmm. The idea that ultimately what Feed the Scousers is saying that people who are poor are feckless, people who are feckless are drunks, they are useless with money, they have learning issues, they are unable to feed themselves and their families. Mostly in the UK now, we've managed to remove the idea of poverty as being something to tar people with in a broad brush way. Everywhere but sort of the political right in this country. It doesn't tend to happen anywhere near as much as it used to anymore. But it still does happen, and people also vote the way they vote, and they vote for what they vote for within that as well. And so it's that is present. But the reason why it's used to abuse Liverpool with, and not, for instance, other places with huge areas of deprivation, which includes the capital city. And it is always worth remembering that the a lot of the places with the greatest inequality in the country and the greatest levels of social depravity in the country actually are London boroughs. What we have to say within that is that it becomes a Liverpool thing because of attitudes that literally go back over 100 years. There's more to this, which is where Liverpool are, and it isn't just the football team, but Liverpool, of the city of Liverpool, not least because there was a long period of time where it was the second biggest city in the whole of England. It has quite a significant cultural handle on the rest of the nation. Liverpool matters to the rest of the nation, whether it's positive or negative, and has done since the 1860s, at the very, very, at the very latest since the 1860s. And that comes with ebbs and flows within that in terms of Liverpool's influence. I would say that at the moment, culturally, Liverpool is the second most significant city in England and possibly in the United Kingdom, but the second most significant city in England in a cultural sort of everyone's got a view on it way is Liverpool. What's, I think, significant at the moment and why in a marketplace around media, which is driven by clicks, is actually there's probably never been a time where there's more positive views about Liverpool. More people are able to experience the city. More people are able to experience the city in a positive way. There is more. There's a lot to be positive about around the city. But what that means, therefore, is you end up, for instance, the piece that you just referenced there a minute ago with the ridiculous headline, is as much exists because they want Liverpool supporters to click it as anything to do with Wolverhampton Wanderers. So we're reporting on the actions of Wolves supporters, but what we want is the huge number of people in this country who give a fuck one way or the other about Liverpool to click it. But that also includes the people who really like Liverpool.
Yeah.
So that's the trade-off all the way through this, and that's what we've got to be really, really careful about. I think the Mail on Sunday thing, I think, is a different thing, because I think that was an attempt to try to use an entirely predictable event to drive a wedge across the country about behaviours positively or negatively, and it just so happened to involve Liverpool, if you sort of see what I mean. I think the way in which the established sort of sports media goes about this and has gone about, like, it's unbelievable the number of stories the MEN carry about Manchester City that have Liverpool in the title or in the SEO. Yeah. It is genuinely staggering, the number of them, and it, you know, I'm not going to say, are people proud of that or anything like that? People have got jobs to do. They're rated on whether or not they get clicks. So I can say what I want, but I might say what people should be made redundant.
But Brennan is so wrapped up in it.
Yeah.
Sue Brennan is so wrapped up in it. Like, I think he would, if he was here now, I don't even think he would say, he would agree with you. I don't even think he would say he's doing it anymore for the clicks or whatever, or because it's like a way of life for the Bellend. Well, like he's put, you know, he's quote tweeted an article. I don't know if you've seen. I only seen it because I don't follow the fucker or anything like that. But it's all lit up, you know, like, because people I know are reacting or liking it or whatever. So there's a piece from Eamon Sweeney, say, in the Independent Sport in Ireland, saying City are the perfect champions for the neoliberal era, true believers in the creed that money makes its own morality, but they're not Liverpool and they never will be, right? Now, okay, Sam, I haven't even read the piece, but I've seen Brennan quote tweet it, such arrogance. When will these people realise that City fans, or any fans of any other club for that matter, from Barcelona to Boreham Wood, really don't want to be Liverpool?
Yeah, but the truth of the matter is that next weekend next Sunday there'll be a parade, and the parade will look fabulous, and it'll be beamed around the globe.
Yeah.
It won't just be beamed in this country; it will be beamed around the globe, and everyone will look at the sea of red. And they may not, whether or not they want to be Liverpool fans, there'll be some part of them, if they are football fans, that will be thinking, "I wish we could have one of them."
Yeah.
And there's loads of reasons why some teams could have one of them. Everton could have one of them. You know, I'm not genuinely, Everton could have one of them, but they've got to get a trophy. And they haven't had one since 1995. You've got to, within that, Manchester United, the next time United wins something mega, the parade on the Mancunian streets, the streets of the city of Manchester, will look staggering. They can have one of them, but they've got to win a trophy. The truth of all of this is, people might not want to be Liverpool supporters. They might not want to be from Liverpool, but they would like some of that in their lives if they're football supporters. But also, if you're from a city, any place really, but certainly if you're from a city somewhere else in England and arguably in the whole of the UK, you probably want that display of civic force as well. You probably want that display of civic power at some level. You want that opportunity at some level. There's a reason why people from London still talk about the 2012 Olympic Games. Yeah. It's exactly the same thing. Look what we did. look what we showed. Look at the way we treated sport. Look at who we are. Look at the vehicle that London was. London has that pride as well. Now, the boroughs of London are separate, as Mo will know better than I do, in that there's then that next level down, which is even more powerful. There's that local, like, fucking Lewisham till I die. All that sort of thing. But it's there. It's what people want. So they may not want to be Liverpool fans or jealous of this, that, or the other, but they are jealous of the idea that Liverpool, both football club and city, are global, that they have this reach and that they pull people in and they give a sense of togetherness. And that creates resentment because it's jealousy. And that's the journey that people go on. They don't want to be Liverpool, but they wish they had some more of Liverpool-esque qualities in their lives.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that Brennan's completely missed the point here, but he has. Because it's not really about what City fans want. It's the people who run the club. They want. They want the love that Liverpool get. They want the love from the world, but also from their own people, the Liverpool get, because that's really what kind of finalises their project, that they are a quote-unquote real football team, because look at all this outpouring of love that comes to the things that we do, and that's what they're not getting. I mean, we literally saw it yesterday. By the way, I do feel a little bit sorry for them doing a parade on a Monday, but then that's what happens when you don't win games. We don't win trophies on Saturdays. You've got to do trophies on Monday. Yep. What can I say? Anyway, but... Yeah, that's really the difference, isn't it? Because that's why this whole idea of why are people thinking that we want to be like Liverpool? Well, because you're always talking about Liverpool, because you're aware of the things that we are and what we do, and you're aware of what the rest of the world thinks about that part. That's why it's so messed up that there is so much. I mean, if you was to talk to football fans in any other country, apart from England, you'd find that loads of the neutrals support Liverpool. Like, people would have their teams, but, like, the people who are just like, oh, I've just not really got a team yet, if you ask them, like, Liverpool, they're the ones, we look like we're having the most fun. We look like playing and supporting Liverpool is a fucking ball, and not every team can say that. And the way that we are able to do that is so hard to quantify that it just drives people insane. And Neil's right, like, all of these people are using us to get whatever it is that they want. So when you can see that that's happening, just let it go.
The soft power matters, and the city of Liverpool's got an enormous amount of soft power, but if you've got any form of power, people won't like the fact that whoever it is, you've got that power. Liverpool culturally has that power. There's another way you can measure this. Honestly, Friday, come to town, have a walk around, play spot the hens. See how many you get. My record's 21 in a 3-hour period. Separate groups of hen parties, knocking around, stag parties, people coming for a weekend, people coming to enjoy the place. We were, during one of the first lockdowns, when Liverpool, you could go out in Liverpool, but there was like a time thing on it, substantial meals era. We were in Pogues, and these two women had just come to Liverpool from Leicester because they wanted a night out. They hadn't had one for God knows how long. You could have one in Liverpool. She would not believe me when I couldn't tell her where the after party was. But all you do is go out and have a great time. It was what she was saying. And I said, no, but, you know, people are broadly trying to sort of stick within the rules, etc., etc. And she was like, oh, come on, there must be somewhere that'll be open after 11. We don't want to just go back to our hotel room. I was like, well, I don't think there is going to be. But the point about that is that's the way. And that stuff matters. It matters that people come here and have fun. It matters that people then go back and say Liverpool was great, as Mo said before. And what is different, I think, between now and, say, the 1980s, is now there's a huge influx of people who want to come and see Liverpool and enjoy Liverpool on a really regular basis. And that's so important to us. And the other thing that's really important, and I think that we all understand that, and I think that the supporters understand that, and I think that the city understands that. For me, the most important thing to protect this city in loads of ways is, if Liverpool isn't everywhere, Liverpool is nowhere. But if Liverpool is everywhere, then Liverpool is powerful. And that's so important to us. And we need the people to come. We need them to really enjoy themselves. We need them to go back and say it's great there, you know. Whether it's football or otherwise, they need to go back and say it's great there, you know.
Yeah, the snake of wheel two cases on Friday and Saturday after a certain time is a sight to behold. if you could just connect the airport a little bit better, that would be great. But anyway, okay, let's move on to the final strike then. I'll start with you on this, Josh, which is Joe Gomez. I think a lot of people are looking in at Joe now and saying, well, you know, he's fit again, he's playing again. When he's had his cameos, he's done quite well. But the facts are that, you know, season long, he's had 1,046 minutes on the pitch for Liverpool. He might be expecting, wanting a little bit more now. That is 21 appearances in total. If you look at the list of appearances for Liverpool this season, you've got Alisson at the very top. He's played 53, started 53 as well. He's played in 53 games. Then you've got Van Dijk on 50. And then, like I say, you've got Joe Gomez way down the list. 21 matches played in, but only actually 11 starts. So what do you think on Joe? Do you think... you've got Aston Villa, who allegedly have been sniffing around. But then equally, other side of the coin, there's actually talk of a new deal at Liverpool. So who knows, we are now officially in silly season.
Yeah, I think Joe Gomez is such an interesting case, to the point that, you know, the two men sitting either side of me and Neil and Mo, I've genuinely had in-depth conversations about Joe Gomez with both of them. Mo in the beer garden of the Glenbrook and Neil somewhere in the office, I believe. Because it is dead interesting. This is a footballer that, you know, for all the world we thought a couple of years ago was going to be our centre-half for the next 10 years, maybe even longer than that. When he partnered Virgil van Dijk that season that saw us win the Champions League, I genuinely thought that Joe Gomez was going to be, you know, not only Liverpool centre-half for the next 10 years, England centre-half for the next 10 years, and it's not quite turned out like that. And part of the reason for that is of course the injuries. But then this season, the thing that happens with injuries that's dead sort of strange, I think, and it's happened to Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain this season as well, and probably in other seasons, is that once you are out the picture because of an injury, and then you come into a period of rehabilitation, if you're not then getting minutes and you're not getting starts and you're not being able to build that rhythm because there are so many other options in the squad, you can quite easily find yourself just constantly on the periphery. And that's the situation that Joe Gomez has found himself in, and I believe that Ibrahim Konaté has a you know, and his sort of adaptation to life in Liverpool has a part. Now, I don't believe that the higher powers at Liverpool expected Konaté to settle as quickly as he has. I don't think they probably expected Joel Matip to have the fitness record that he's had over the course of this season. I think if you'd have sat down with Jurgen Klopp and Pep Linders and Alex Inglethorpe and whoever at the start of the season and said, how many games do you project that all these will play, they'd probably have Joe Gomez a lot closer to where Konaté and Matip now sit, because they believe that he would have played so many more games for Liverpool. And that's now the conundrum that they have when they sit down with Joe Gomez in the summer, and when they have a chat about his future, is that, look, they can sit down with Gomez in the same way they could sit down with Chamberlain, the same way they could sit down with Minamino and say, you've actually played, you know, 20 odd games this season. You could go and play 30 odd games for Aston Villa next season. But the obvious difference here is the trophies. The obvious difference here is Champions League football. It's, you know, Joe Gomez, you could In any world, and it wouldn't be really unlikely, start in a League Cup final next season. You could start in an FA Cup final next season. You could so easily find yourself playing in a showpiece event for Liverpool Football Club. It's genuinely that close, and that would be, if I was one of the coaches or one of the sort of front office of Liverpool, that would be what I'd be saying to Joe Gomez, is you're actually so close to this thing that you want. Like, it takes the smallest sort of switch for that to be the case. But then if you go to Aston Villa, you may play 10 to 15 more games a season, but you're not going to get all these other aspects. And then it becomes up to Joe Gomez, I think. And I always say this on shows when we talk about players leaving, is the idea that Liverpool under Jurgen Klopp has barely ever sold a Jurgen Klopp bought player against their will. I know Joe Gomez is not a Jurgen Klopp bought player, but he's a player that Jurgen Klopp really likes and really values. And that to me means something. It's that if Joe Gomez went into Jurgen Klopp's office in the summer and went, look, boss, Aston Villa want me, I think it's a great opportunity, I want to move, Jurgen Klopp will go, absolutely fine, I'm not going to stand in your way. I'd be really sad to lose you, but I'm not going to stand in your way. I'm not going to keep you against your will. But equally, if Joe Gomez came in and went, boss, I want to fight for my place next season, I want to have the chance to start in the League Cup final and FA Cup final, I want all these winners' medals, Jurgen Klopp will go, absolutely made up, give him a big hug and say, see you on the training ground next season and bring your A game, basically. And that's the situation that I think we find ourselves in at the moment with Joe.
But it's 7 years now at Liverpool for Joe Neil. Two more years to run on his contract. Mm-hmm. Obviously, would take him up to nine. And it seemingly, this idea of a new contract seems to have come from the Midlands, in that, you know, the Midland reporter, John Percy, I think it is, has said that he was on Aston Villa's radar, to use the parlance, as if he's got a fucking radar. Yeah. Joe Gomez. but now it's, they believe at their end that he's signing a new contract at Liverpool.
I'd gladly have Joe Gomez play 18 years at Liverpool. That's how good I think he is, and that's how important I think he can be. I think it's been difficult this season for a variety of reasons. One of those things genuinely is, and fair play to Liverpool for this, not least because they made a couple of changes during the course of last season around player recovery and stuff like that, is that ultimately they kept Joel Matip absolutely fully fit. So that then gives the manager a bit of a headache. Also, Matip had a very good pre-season. I think he was not as injured as Joe Gomez in that journey as well, so recovery wasn't as complex. And the other thing that undermines Joe is Virgil wasn't 100% for 4 months, if we're all honest about it now, you know, because we've got to see him be 100%, and my God, it's lovely. So we can see that then he was sort of, there's periods where I'd argue Virgil may well have only been 80%, but the manager rightly put all of his eggs in the get Van Dijk 100% basket. It was the right basket to put his eggs in, and there's no argument with that from anybody. And I'd like there to be no argument with that from Joe himself to a degree, like, because footballers aren't stupid. So I think, though, there's such a place for him. When we had all that big conversation about what the manager wasn't sure quite what to go for the game against Tottenham, you know, with Konate or Matip, did he in the end do the wrong one? All of that sort of stuff. My position was, well, the right one, if he was fully fit and flying, would have been Joe Gomez. He would have been the right one for that sort of game. Mm-hmm. And I think that that still is, there's still a massive place for him. The other thing to point out, you know, people are going to begin to engage with it in a much more straightforward way very soon, is that the first half, well, all the next season, but the first half of next season is going to be an absolute bloodbath in terms of getting players on the pitch. We've got another reality. I think that the best player to play when Van Dijk doesn't play in that left-hand side of centre-half role is Gomez. Yeah. We've got another reality, which is, I think, that the Dutch will feel they can go deep into that World Cup. Mm-hmm. And it's worth remembering that if you play the semi-final, you've also got to play a third, fourth place playoff. So I think that there's going to be a lot of room next season. I think Virgil himself, and I'm sure in lots of ways the manager will want to say there'll be a lot of Virgil, but I think there'll actually be more room for a little bit more rotation. And then if Holland do go far, I think there'll be a reluctance from Liverpool just to ask Van Dijk just to keep going. I think they might want to try and get him a little bit of rest in there somewhere too. So I think there's loads of opportunities for Gomez next season. It wouldn't surprise me if there is a new deal. It's a good time for a new deal. Liverpool can get him tied down for the next sort of 4 or 5 years. It wouldn't surprise me if there's a gentleman's agreement with the manager around that new deal, which is, we will move you on next summer if you feel as though you haven't had opportunities in order to be able to make your way through on that. I would not be surprised if that was the case, because I think that the manager, he sees himself, and we hear the language he uses, everyone's on a one-year deal with him. So all the players, so if the manager and Gomez and Liverpool's hierarchy come to another one-year deal, it's another one-year deal. Might there be a new contract with a bit of a boost and all that sort of stuff? Absolutely. But the point is, we do this season, and then if you want to move on, you come and see me, and we'll do the best we can for you. That's the way it feels like Liverpool operates. But I think, Joe Gomez, your numbers there, my gamble would be, if you'd ask me to, my hunch now is that the numbers that you've just put there, and certainly in terms of number of minutes and in terms of number of starts, it doubles.
Yep.
That's what I think. I think it'll double.
Yeah, I mean, 17, 18, he's turning out in 23 league games. 19, 20, he's turning out in 28 league games and makes 43 appearances in total that season. That's the high for Joe Gomez, if you like. But this season, just 8 appearances in the league, Mark.
First things first, happy birthday, Joe. It was his birthday yesterday.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Timing.
Thanks. And second of all, he's 25, by the way.
Yeah, 25. Younger than Nat Phillips.
Yes, younger than Nat Phillips. And 6 years younger than both Virgil van Dijk and Matip. And that's what we've all been talking about in terms of, he has to bide his time to that point. And it's easier for us sitting here saying bide his time when he's watching Liverpool potentially play for everything. A season like this, when you're on the periphery of the team, must be harder than a season when you're struggling, I think, because you're literally saying, okay, well, these are the moments where I'm supposed to be making for memories for the rest of my life, and all the memories is going to be me or sitting on the soft bench with a jacket on. And you can see how that would get to him. But I echo all of what Neil said about next season. I do think that was a big part of it. I think it feels like to me that he's changed his mind in recent, and quite a bit even just in recent times. I personally think the game against Watford was massive, because that was the first time back in the replacing Trent where everyone was like, wow, he can do it. He got the assist, but it wasn't just the assist. It was just, he looked like a guy who was like, okay, I'm going to attack the fuck out of playing right back here, and I'm going to do absolutely everything that a right back is needed to do. And he did it. And he built confidence from that. Not just confidence in himself, confidence from everybody else. Okay, you can feel that. And yes, he doesn't want to be a backup right back. We know he doesn't want to be a backup right back, but being able to be in and around the pitch, being able to be on the pitch, being able to contribute to the games is still better than nothing. And I think contributing to the games and playing big games as a reserve right back beats playing 30 games in the Premier League starting for Aston Villa alongside Tyrone Mings, to be fair.
Fulham was another link, wasn't it?
On that 1920 season, there are things to remember in it where he ultimately was still coming back from the injury at the start of the campaign. He doesn't get that many starts beyond Super Clubs, Community Shield and Super Cup. I mean, it's the underrated thing is that in the autumn of 2019, Dejan Lovren plays a lot of games for Liverpool that everyone very much forgot quickly. But then you look at where he ended up, and he basically features in every match, bar, weirdly, the Watford collapse. He starts every game, every league game from the 7th of December. So he's in every other league setup as Liverpool go on that run. Well, the whole thing was a run, but as Liverpool end the process of winning the title, you know, Lovren comes back in for that one at Watford, which is the flip side. We're always with the Lovren conversation. Lovren comes back in for that one at Watford, and then as quickly as possible, they get Gomez back. You know, he started the game against Bournemouth just before COVID. He then started the game against Atletico, which obviously doesn't go as we'd like. All the way through, he started the 4-0 against Palace, the other side of COVID. He starts then in the Etihad. You know, he really is there for this manager in the run that wins us the title. That's how good he is. They know how good he is. And the other thing is, he was really impressive in the brief period before the next injury. When Van Dijk had gone out. And that's the Gomez future is someone needs to play when Van Dijk doesn't. And if I was at Liverpool, I'd be saying, you're going to be next season our fella who plays when Van Dijk doesn't. And you're going to get some games next to Virgil as well. And there might be bits for you at right back, though I do think they'll do the young lad at right back.
The other thing I think that's key for me in all of this as well is we talk about pre-season. One thing that Klopp has always preached is that you can reset every year in pre-season. So Joe hasn't played as much as he wanted to this season, but he's kept himself fit, he's kept himself sharp to be able to go into pre-season and attack it and come out of pre-season as the first choice partner for Virgil. I mean, you were saying, Josh, you would see him playing League Cup finals, FA Cup finals. I can see him playing the Champions League final next season. Yeah. I can. He is good enough to do that. And we might be sitting here in 6 months saying, wow, what happens to Joe Matip? He hasn't been playing a lot of games recently. It's like, well, yeah, because Joe Gomez is still Joe Gomez.
Yeah, and he's also bigger and harder than you would expect in real life, as well as being a lovely fella. So he's 100% on Klopp's team sound, which we know is a big deal to staying in the squad. Okay, well, that was really good. Three strikes. Really enjoyed it. Good chats on all subjects. Hope you enjoyed it too out there. Do send us your ideas for topics, because we do listen, as I have just proven with the topics today. Thanks to the panel. All brilliant today. And yeah, up the Reds. We'll do another one soon.